Lynn Hiles Ministries presents Dr. Lynn Hiles, That You Might Have Life. And here's your host, Dr. Lynn Hiles.
Thank you for joining us again this week on the program. This is the fourth segment that we are filming on the 14th chapter of Revelation. And I know that probably some of this is stretching you. It's stretching me a little bit. But as I continue to follow the preponderance of evidence, it becomes pretty much clearer to me what's really being said here, that sometimes we've taken a 21st century mindset and tried to apply it to ancient scriptures that can only be interpreted by using other scriptures. Now, before I get into the teaching today, let me say to you that you can go back and review any of these teachings on our YouTube channel. And you can also get the audio feed from our podcast and from our RSS feed. And the easiest way to do that is to go to my website at lynnhiles.com. In the upper right-hand corner, there are icons that will take you directly to my channel. There's all kinds of stuff on YouTube out there from other places that people have shared. But if you go to my channel on YouTube, you will be able to see these things right in order and the playlist like they are without having to search around for this chapter and that chapter. It's all dated. And please subscribe to that channel because it will then notify you every time we upload one. It doesn't cost you anything to do that, but every time you watch that, it is a blessing to us to know. Let me also say that we're super, super excited about the release of this new study guide that just came out right before Thanksgiving called A Study Guide of the Biblical Last Days, A Victorious Eschatology. And this book is dealing with an overview of the biblical last days from a fulfilled perspective and a victorious eschatology. And it has questions and answers in this book. It is a study guide. It has a QR code in the first part of this book where you can scan it and go watch the videos where this series was taken from, a webinar that I did in the middle of the COVID epidemic in 2020. And if you are afraid and you've got loved ones fearful, or you want to introduce them to these concepts that I'm sharing in a more exhaustive way here on television, go get this book from Amazon today because it will be a great blessing to you to be able to read it, and I think you could share it with other people. And if you can see this commercial before Christmas, they would make great Christmas gifts. All right, I want to go to 14 again. I'm going to read from verse 9, try to bring some things together again. It says, "And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast, his image, receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same will drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture in the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb." I think that's interesting to note as well, that this fire and brimstone is in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the holy and of the presence of the Lamb. And as I told you last week, our God is a consuming fire. And perhaps we need to kind of look at this this fire as being a judgment, but also being a judgment unto victory. A bruised reed and a smoking flax he will not quench till he sends forth judgment unto victory. And as you go on through this book of Revelation chapter 15, you're going to see especially they got the victory. They stood on top of a sea of glass mingled with fire, and they had gotten the victory over the beast and the number of his name, and they stood on top of the sea of glass. I showed you last week how Deuteronomy, I believe it is chapter 28 or 29, was talking about the curses from Deuteronomy, that it would be, the land would be full of fire and brimstone, like the fire and brimstone that was upon Sodom and Gomorrah, that it would be the wrath of God poured out on the apostate children of Israel because of their adulterous affair with the idols and the gods that he said that they would worship after the death of Moses. It says, "And the smoke of their torment ascends up forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night, nor will worship the beast in his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name." Here's the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. "And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works do follow them. One of the comments I want to make about this, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord. First of all, I think I made it pretty clear to you last week when we started to take a look at maybe there's some things we need to rethink concerning fire and brimstone. But one of the things that I was made clear to you, and I still want to be clear, regardless of how you see this, whether you think this is an eternal torment that is in the future for people who die, or this was God keeping his end of the covenant bargain on Israel, or that this fire is the part that's eternal, which I lean towards the fact that our God is a consuming fire, so he never ceases to be that fire. But when I look at that, I also wanted to just say how much I believe that it is strong enough language to me that says that you're blessed if you die in faith. Blessed are the dead that die in the Lord from henceforth. In other words, for those who sing the song of redemption, and no matter what you believe about, whether you teach eternal conscious torment, whether you teach annihilation, whether you teach ultimate reconciliation, or whether you teach universalism, this language is strong enough for me to tell you that it's telling you that it's a definite benefit to dying in faith. Now, not only is it a definite benefit to dying in faith, it's a definite benefit to live in the faith. But when I see this, I see that, first of all, as being a part of you're blessed if you die in the Lord, because that's not, eternal fire is not reserved for you. Matter of fact, death and hell, which it would take another multiples of studies to go into the fact that King James translates several different Greek words and Hebrew words. It translates them as hell that are not talking about the same place. There's a Hades, there is a Sheol, there is a Gehenna, and there is a Tartaru. And when you see Gehenna, it is outside the city. It was the one that Jesus talked about more than anything, that during the siege of Jerusalem, the bodies were being thrown over the wall in such multitudes that the fire was not quenched and the worm was not dying. And it was in the valley of Hinnom, or in the valley of Gehenna, that they were cast into this fire. Of course, it was also the place where they would throw, when the Sanhedrin would pronounce death on somebody, that they would be judged and thrown into that valley, because it was the potter's field that was a field that was full of broken vessels. And I am going to stretch you just a little bit to consider this as a possibility, is the Valley of Hinnom was the place where there was broken vessels. And it was the potter's field that Jeremiah was told, go buy the potter's field, because the potter could buy that field, because in that field were vessels that could be made over again. And that he would buy that field because he would see value in those broken pieces of pottery that he could go. And that has ramifications on this side of the grave. And whatever you want to do with that is up to you. But I will say this to you. I think it's incredibly important that the scripture pointed out that when Judas committed suicide and he hanged himself, that the Bible takes great pain to point out that his bowels burst asunder. When his bowels burst asunder, what was in his bowels was the elements of communion that Jesus had served the disciples, and including Judas, the night before his decease. When he said he gave even the sop to the one who dipped his hand, he gave it to Peter who would betray him, he gave it to Judas. But Judas's bowels were full of the communion elements that spattered all over the Valley of Hinnom. And the prophet Jeremiah said he bought that field because in a great house there are vessels fitted to destruction and some wrath and some, you know, but that he could take those vessels that in one day were, if you could even look back at that as being a type of, you see, before the cross, the only people involved in the covenants of promise were the Jews. That means that Pharaoh could not have gotten saved if he would have wanted to. He was a vessel that was fitted to destruction. But did God leave them there? I don't know. The scripture says that Jesus went into hell and preached to the spirits who were in captivity. Perhaps there is a way to look at this where there might possibly be an opportunity for a post-mortem experience where if the gospel was preached to them after that, and Jesus has the keys of death and hell, perhaps he still has the ability to reach into those dimensions and bring redemption to the vessels that were broken to shivers, and that this fire, although it is destructive in nature, what happens in Revelation chapter number 20 is that death and hell are cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And so death and hell, which is Hades and Sheol, and some of these words that are used were cast into the lake of fire. It is absolutely God's full ratification of the destruction of death, because he came to redeem us. Remember that the wages of sin under the old covenant were death. I don't know why you'd up the ante when you got into a better covenant called the new covenant. If the wages of sin were death, Jesus came to redeem us from sin, sickness, poverty, and death. Perhaps that lake of fire could be used as a place. And I know this is just really stretching some of you. I'm just saying, consider this as a possibility. These are things I'm considering. And when I teach this, I just want to say, I'm not dogmatic about any of this. I simply want us to say, maybe there's another way to look at this. And it's redemptive, because in Revelation chapter 15, they stood on top of this sea of glass that was mingled with fire, and they got the victory over the beast and the number of his name. So perhaps death and hell are cast into the lake of fire, and that's the second death, and the second death is simply a death to the first one. And so it's God removing death and moving it from the through the process of the fire that may be purging, and not just being destructive, and that God was bringing redemption to people even through that kind of a thing. That's just a possibility to consider. And so, you know, as I think about some of the terminology that's used here, somebody said, well, you mean you think the devil will be saved? Well, I think that there's a different word in Jude when he talks about the angels that left their first estate. They were reserved into the everlasting chains of Tartaru, which is a totally different Greek word than Hades or Sheol or the lake of fire that burns with fire and brimstone. Our God is a consuming fire. As a matter of fact, this word brimstone comes from the word theon, and the root word is theo, which is God. Our God is a consuming fire. And yes, there is a judgment, and there is a fire that you would want to avoid. And no matter how you see this, I think it to be possibly age enduring, because the rest of the dead do not live again till the 1,000 years are finished. So one thing that unbelievers miss is they miss the life of the coming age, which was the aeonian life that was being offered to those coming into the new covenant. But those who had already received Christ had the life of the coming age. They had eternal life already in their spirit. They were already the ones. And so when he's saying, blessed are the dead that die in the Lord from henceforth, he's talking about it's a blessing, number one, to die in faith. Number two, after the demise of this city and the destruction of the temple, those who had been held in the grave had not been resurrected until after the resurrection of Christ, which would be the resurrection of Christ, and then they were seen in this city, many that were came out of the graves in Matthew 27, and were seen in the city, that would be Christ and the first fruits. Afterward, they that are Christ at his coming, which I believe to be in AD 70. And so after AD 70, what he was referring to here is what Paul was in 1 Thessalonians 4. I'm going to show you a mystery. We will not all sleep, but we will be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. Well, the last trumpet sounds in Revelation 7, right after the siege of the Romans for the 42-month that they tread the city underfoot. And so when you see that, you have to kind of take a look and say, you know, maybe this judgment that we're talking about is a judgment that is producing something. And we're gonna look at some more of this stuff here, even as a horse is brought up, because it relates to some things that are involved here. But when he's saying, "Blessed are the dead of the dying," the Lord, he's saying again, up until that resurrection that took place, I believe in 70 A.D., because the way into the most holy place, into heaven itself, was not yet made while the first tabernacle still stood. But at the destruction of the temple and the removal of the old covenant system and that covenant of death, that death in hell, Isaiah said that your covenant with death would be annulled and your agreement with hell will be broken. That once that temple was destroyed, now the way into the most holy place, into heaven itself, was open, and saints now, from that point on, do not sleep. The contrast must be made. That every Old Testament saint that you read and you study, you start to see, well, when they died and they gathered their feet into the bed and they slept with their fathers. The reason they slept was because until the resurrection of Christ, they slept. What Paul was telling them in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 is, we will not all sleep. From here on out, there's a blessedness to dying in the Lord from us, those of us who are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord will not prevent or precede those who've fallen asleep. But for us post 70 AD, we don't sleep, so we're blessed to die in the Lord. And so there is a winepress then that is trodden outside of the city, and it flows to horse's bridle. Let me just go and read some of these notes, because what's going to happen is I'm going to run out of time, and I want us to look at some of this stuff that I was able to find in some of my research. I'm just going to read some of this. Josephus writes concerning the Roman soldiers. After they had burned down the temple in Jerusalem, they ran everyone through whom they had met with and obstructed the very lanes with their dead bodies, and made the whole city run down with blood to such a degree, indeed, that the fire of many houses was quenched with these men's blood. That's from the War of the Jews, from Josephus, I believe it is 6:8:5. The amount of blood that flowed not only in Jerusalem but also throughout the surrounding region could possibly bring to mind a passage like Revelation 14:19-20, which says, so the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the great harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God, and the winepress was trodden outside the city, and the blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia, or 184 miles. Now, let me just stop for a moment here and say this was trampled outside the city, and the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out for 1,600 stadia, or 184 miles. This was the understanding of John Wesley also, who in his commentary on this passage wrote, and the winepress was trodden by the Son of God in Revelation 19, verse 15, outside the city of Jerusalem. They to whom St. John writes, when a man said, the city immediately understood this blood, and a blood came out of the winepress, even to the horses' bridles, so deep at its first flowing from the winepress, 1,600 furlongs, so far at least 200 miles through the whole land of Palestine. Wesley, like many, tied today this passage of Revelation 14 to Revelation 19, and rightly so, this often referred to as the Battle of Armageddon. Now, author John Noe, on the other hand, notes that what the Bible refers to as the battle of the great day of God Almighty would transpire at the place in the Hebrew, which is called Armageddon. In Hebrew, it actually is Har, H-A-R, Megeddon, as Har means mountain in Hebrew, and is based on the Greek rendering, since the H is silent. Therefore, this battle was to take place primarily on the mountain, not in a valley, Noe adds. The most likely case is the revelation is Har is Jerusalem. Geographically, Jerusalem sets on top of a mountain to give there from any direction. One must go up to Jerusalem, and there are multiple scriptures for that. Jerusalem is also called God's holy mountain, or the chief among the mountains. So Megiddo may also be comparative imagery. Great slaughter once took place in the valley of Megiddo in 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 27, Zechariah 12, and verse 11. Throughout ancient history, this valley was also a favorite quarter for invading armies and the scene of numerous famous battles. 1 Samuel chapter 29, verses 31, and 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 1. There's multiple listings. I won't give you all of them. So much blood was shed in this valley of Jezreel or Megiddo that it became a synonym for slaughter, violence, bloodshed, and battlefield, as well as a symbol for God's judgment. Hosea 1, verses 4 through 5. In our day, Armageddon has also become synonymous with a symbol for the ultimate warfare and conflict, very similar to the fashion of the word Waterloo has garnered a symbolic use back in 1815. This town in Belgium was the battleground of the scene of Napoleon's final defeat. Today, we have a saying that some are first saying that we have a saying that someone or something has met their Waterloo. In other words, it's used as a symbolic language. We don't mean that they have met in the city of Europe. We mean they met their demise through that particular thing. History records the great slaughter that took place on a mountain in Palestine within the lifetime of the original recipients of the Book of Revelation. In AD 70, the Roman armies of Titus totally destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. According to Eusebius, 1.1 million Jews were killed. This description by Josephus also shows how the fulfillment of this prophecy could have taken place during the Jewish-Roman War. And then he goes on to say, now this destruction that fell upon the Jews, it was not inferior to any. This is from Josephus, the writing of the War of the Jews from 67 to 73 AD, regarding which he provides the following account. Now the destruction that fell upon the Jews, as it was not inferior to any of the rest in itself, so did it all appear greater than it really was. And this because not only of the whole of the country through which they had fled was filled with slaughter, and the Jordan River could not be passed over by reason of the dead bodies that were in it because of the Lake Asphaltis. Now, the Lake Asphaltis is also known as the modern Dead Sea. But I want you to see that because the Lake Asphaltis could be connected to the Lake of Fire. And see, it says the modern Dead Sea was also full of dead bodies that were carried down into it by the river. And now Placidus, after this good success that he had fell violently upon the neighboring smaller cities and villages, which he took Albala and Julius and Bizamoth, and all those lay as far as the Lake Asphaltis, and put such of the deserters into each of them as he thought proper. He then put his soldiers on board ships and slew such as had fled to the lake, insomuch that all Perea had surrendered themselves and were taken by the Romans as far as Marcarus. And that was Josephus' account of the Lake Asphaltis and the War of the Jews 4, verse 7 and 6. Now, I already compared it with the Red Sea, but when I started to look at this, one must also consider that the stadia, approximately 184 miles or 960 kilometers, or 296 kilometers in Revelation, can be compared to the length of the Jordan River. I thought this was interesting. In ways that provide additional symbolic meaning, particularly from the preterist perspective. The length of the Jordan River flows approximately 156 miles or 251 kilometers from its source in the north of Mount Hermon to the Dead Sea. This measurement is close to the 1600 stadia described in Revelation 14, verse 2, which could suggest a deliberate symbolic connection to the entire land of Israel. Connection between 1600 stadia and the Jordan River, symbolizing Israel's full judgment. The Jordan River spans the geographic heart of Israel, running from the northmost regions to the southern Dead Sea. In other words, it flowed with so much blood until the Jordan had turned red. The 1600 stadia may reflect the idea that the judgment described in Revelation 14:20 encompasses the whole land of Israel, as Jordan symbolically cuts through the promised land. Jordan as a covenant symbol. The Jordan River is rich in biblical covenant significance. It was the point of interest, point of Israel entering into the promised land, and could be significant of them coming out of Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, coming across the Jordan River now that was flowing with blood, and into their promised land as seen in the fulfillment of the new Exodus being completely now coming to an end, and the people coming into their new promised land. The blood flowing along the symbolic length of Jordan could represent the end of the old covenant Israel and the judgment of those who rejected Christ, the new covenant mediator. The geographic scope of the devastation described in Revelation is often linked to the Roman-Jewish War of 66 to 70 AD, which affected the entire region. The connection to the Jordan's length may emphasize that the bloodshed extended from Galilee in the north, where the conflict in Jerusalem, and beyond the south. Jordan's destination was into the Dead Sea, where it was like there was no life in that. So it's really a symbol of a lot of judgment. The Jordan River flows into the Dead Sea, a symbol of death and barrenness. The imagery of blood flowing over the land to the Dead Sea region reinforces the totality of the judgment and covenant-breaking generation faces, their destruction, their fate ending in death and separation from the promises of God. The 1600 stadia and the Jordan course both symbolize totally the totality and judgment across the land of Israel. In conclusion, the 1600 stadia and the Jordan River can be seen as parallel symbolic measures of the judgment and that befell Israel. Just as the Jordan represents the full length of the promised land and 1600 stadia imagery reinforces the idea of complete devastation and divine retribution across the covenant land in 70 AD, and then the Lake Asphaltis is an ancient name for the Dead Sea, a hypersaline body of water located at the lowest point of the earth between modern Israel and Jordan in the West Bank. The name Asphaltis refers to the natural bitumen that would occasionally rise to the surface of the lake, a characteristic noticed by ancient historians. It literally had asphalt that rose to all of that would come to the top of the thing. It would surface with asphalt. There's so much. The Dead Sea is also located near the historical site of Sodom and Gomorrah. The city is destroyed by fire and brimstone as a result of the divine judgment. And so there's so much that could be said here, but also wanted to say that there's also a connection to the one whose vesture was dipped in blood. In Isaiah 63, verse 3, it says, "I have trod the winepress alone in the nations, from the nations, and no one was with me. I trampled them in my anger and trod them in my wrath. Their blood spattered my garments and stained all my clothing." Meaning the treading of the wine represents God's active role in executing judgment, with the blood symbolizing the destruction of his enemies. And you can see that through a whole lot of different scriptures. And so there's a lot of imagery that could be compared there. But the bottom line is, in conclusion, please notice that Revelation 15, they're the ones that get the victory over the beast and the number of his name, and they're standing on top of the sea of glass. But if you see, all of this imagery is connected to the judgment that was upon apostate Israel in the first century, and it may have ongoing ramifications. I'm not saying God doesn't have judgment or doesn't deal with people in this day. I am saying he doesn't deal with them on the basis of an old covenant paradigm. We've crossed into the promised land, and we sing the song of the Lamb. We're out of time. If you'd like to sow a seed into the ministry, please go to our website there. You can see the address on the screen, and you can sow a seed via credit card or debit card. You can set up a monthly debit if you'd like to become a monthly partner, or you can give a one-time gift. You can also send a check or money order to the address that will come on the screen, and you can call the number that's on the screen, and someone will take your call. You can also go and order this book, as when you ordered it, a lot of the proceeds help us to stay on the air. But do it today. God bless you. Thank you for joining us again this week. Wouldn't it be incredibly good news if the last days are past days and not in your future? What if you don't have to face a future 7 years of hell on earth called the Great Tribulation and worry about a future mark of the beast? What if you discovered that these events happened in the past and were written about to a first century church and are not in our future? If this interests you, then this study guide will be well worth your time as it explores these and other subjects in great detail.